best. Level, level. Good. Oh, upper body.
At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Thursday. Race fans, Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964, and back with the stream running live after yesterday. And actually, Casey, I haven't heard, you forgot to tell me, I didn't hear the specifics about the court. Casey said the court date was a complete cluster mess, and so I haven't heard the specifics. You'll have to tell me after the show, but thanks to Brian yesterday for pitching in and getting us on the air, at least live, and then Case got the stream up and running a little bit after lunch, so that worked out okay. A week from Thanksgiving, we'll be off next Wednesday and Thursday. We've seemingly gotten into a nice, I think, a nice swing on that. We tried all different combinations, right? We tried Thursday, Friday. And that wasn't really good because Friday, you know, Thanksgiving, big, obviously, big weekend of racing. So the last few years, I think we've been, because I got to cook. I mean, we got a dozen people, and not as big as the gigantic. I mean, there was one year where we had to go. We went and bought a couple of folding tables at BJ's and and sort of extended it from the dining room into the middle room. We must have had 20. Must have had like 20, 22 people. There's a picture of it. So we didn't have a children's table. How many of you? Deal with the Thanksgiving children's table. That's right. So we are today, because it is a week out, and rather than wait till Monday or Tuesday and try to shove it in, Neil Kleinberg, the impresario of Clinton Street Baking Company, Neil will join us at 10:30, answer your questions. He will talk about experimentation, what he's doing this year, because we all tinker. We all have little nuancy. I'm gonna ask Neil his opinion on playing around with the tradition. I mean, there's a set of core Thanksgiving standards that you won't mess with, but. For a long period of time, I would keep tinkering with different ways of seasoning the turkey before really just sort of settling back into the habit and practice taught to me by my mother. It's very, very, I mean, really simple. Kept it very simple the last several years. The most incredible one, of course, was I've talked about being up in Montreal and Canadian Thanksgiving, which corresponds to Columbus Day in the U.S., Indigenous Peoples Day. And I smoked a gigantic fresh turkey that I got at the Atwater Market. It was like a 26-pound turkey. And I brined it and then smoked it. I mean, almost, I mean, it was probably 18 hours, but I guess based on the weight, I forget how I, what I discovered. But I will tell you, we had just a riot, me and Sebastian, my roommate, and, we're out on the back porch. You got to really attend to a smoking, this was with small pile of smoldering charcoal with, the flavored wood chips on top. In the corners, it was an egg-shaped, it was not one of the green eggs, but it was an oval a big oval-shaped grill. And, you know, looking at it, I said, you know what? I could put a turkey in the middle and you know, put the drip pans on it, all that stuff. And it was unbelievable, truly unbelievable. And what was fun about it was, you know, we basically, people kept coming over. I mean, when we had the actual Thanksgiving, when everybody, it was literally an all-day, it was an all-day affair. Started, you know, probably about 2 o'clock, people started coming, and they came till 10 o'clock at night. My where I lived in Montreal on St. Mathieu was a bit of a way station. You know, people would stop, you know, our friends from all over, you know, all over Montreal would stop at the apartment first, party, you know, in advance of going out around downtown, or all over, you know, St. Catherine and Saint Laurent and so forth. And then they would circle back and come back later. And so it was boy, oh boy. Not a bad place to live in your 30s, to say the least. There are still things I do remember from that 10 years. Neil Kleinberg, I've already got a couple of questions that have been emailed, and we also got the question, our friend Todd Engel, Syracuse. Todd has got to do a vegetarian version, so we'll ask about that. And of course, Steve Haskin for years would talk about the tofurkey. So we'll see about Neil providing some vegetarian options. I mean, Thanksgiving overall is a vegetarian friendly, you know, meal anyhow. I mean, you can bypass the turkey and focus on all the sides. Yeah, the vegan, that's a little bit tougher. You can start eliminating some of the other, you know, things. But, yeah, still, even then. So we're looking forward, as always, one of our favorite segments of the year. And, of course, we'll get an update on the Clinton Street Baking Company locations around the world and see how everything is with Neil. And you know, his son is back from L.A., and he's got something new that he's involved in, and his wife Dee Dee, of course, that has what is it, up by Columbia Commerce, which is a vegetarian place, as it happens, famous, one of the oldest of its kind in New York. So anyway, looking forward to that. Looking forward to Dave Hill. We'll do Dave. You know, Dave. I guess what do you? Either he regressed, or either he bounced off the big week, the 10-2-1 week. I guess he bounced or regressed back to the mean. I don't know. However you decide that. Dave Hill will be here, and we'll see what Thanksgiving is like in the Washitas. what a hot springs Thanksgiving. We'll get Dave's because I never had the chance to ask him that, right? That he's coming into the line of fire, the annual survey of all the guests and regulars between now and Tuesday. What's your, you know, your favorite dish? And I was impressed that I remembered that Pat McKenna was a mashed potato guy. The mashed potatoes, we've gotten away. I've told you this. We've gotten away from the mashed potatoes. And it all started with that crazy Hanukkah. The Hanukkah Thanksgiving mashup from a few years ago. It's probably 10 years ago already. It was the craziest thing ever. I mean, you grew up my whole life. Hanukkah was never, not one time do I remember Hanukkah being during Thanksgiving. Or Thanksgiving being during Hanukkah. So next thing we know, we're making latkes for Hanukkah. And that divergence, that prompted, you know, a whole new look at potatoes. We tried the Hasselbeck potato, where you take the, it's a real tchotchke. You take the sharp knife and you put like 30 slices you know, 75% of the way down in the potato, and then the potato sort of opens up like an accordion. It's gorgeous. It's a beautiful presentation, but we tried those 1 year, but then we settled in on the au gratin, and the au gratin has been the go-to. Even Tina, who is a mashed potato aficionado, even she gave up the mashed potato demand. Yeah? So she's now into the au gratin. So, Thanksgiving with Neil Kleinberg, 10:30. Dave Hill at 11. We've got, in this hour, coming up fairly soon, we have called this the equal time hour from yesterday. Two visits back-to-back. Gary West. Yesterday, it was the triumphant return of Dr. Allday after way too long of a layoff. Probably an 8 or 9 month layoff. And I'll tell you what, absolute wire-to-wire win. Dr. Stephen Allday, Horse Health Today, brought to you by Luberson and Reborn. The opportunity to talk to Gary, based on his, you know, very pointed treatment of the Flightline career and retirement. So we'll let Gary flesh out in his always smooth and mellifluent delivery. It'll be great to talk to Gary. And we'll catch up on other things with Gary West as well. He'll be followed by Pat Cummings, because I'm just going to sit back. I want Pat to explain this a little bit, you know, maybe a little bit more succinctly than in written form, because the written form, I told you, I read it twice and my eyes crossed. I just, the whole thing with the L'Affaire Quinella. Yes. J'accuse. we'll let Pat explain. And listen, nobody's not saying there aren't episodes of attempts to manipulate pools. We know there are. I mean, they're reported on and they're noticed, and they don't go undetected. They're pretty obvious. They're pretty glaring, actually. So this one, though, is weird, because, okay, somebody identified a 40-to-1 that they were trying to get first or second, and, you know, $18,000 ends up being paid out to players that had the horses that were first and second. So they were delighted, probably paid 5 or 6 times what it would have, because they misfired. I mean, how is this any different than the, how is it any different than, well, I don't know, I'm talking out loud. I'll let Pat answer this. How is it any different than when the computer groups, when they misidentify, you know, the overlays, the way the computer, you know, the algorithm is reaching for, you know, to basically balance out the will pays so that, you know, so that their bets, you know, at the very least break even, and it, you know, it depresses the exacta payouts, particularly for everybody else. Okay, they don't cover every single combination, and there's plenty of occasions when we're the beneficiary of the inefficiencies, most notably on wet tracks. And when there's off the turf, because the groups can't seem to, their system, you know, seems to really misfire. I mean, it turns into Hal. What are you doing, Dave? The you could tell I'm in one of those moods. The I'm going to turn it over to Pat. I don't need to expand on this. So you'll be, you know, I don't want to get too far into it when we're going to have to do it with Pat. All right, a couple of quick notes before. Let me. There's the Gary West piece. Let's get that out of here. And let's see. There's the Pat Cummings piece here. Let me get the forklift. We kid because we love. That's right. Oh boy. Yesterday, I got to slip this in before we get going. There were some interesting results yesterday at Churchill, off the turf, by the way, in New York today. I tweeted that out as soon as the racing office let it be known. Completely. Hopefully, you know, for the weekend and for these upcoming turf opportunities, I hope that we get in as many as we possibly can. But yesterday, how about that maiden? And I have not gone back to see about what kind of a number, but the Brad Cox, you had that Brad Cox filly, the Intermischief, Dazzling Blue for Judmont. Just went to the front and improved the position. Pulled a Jay Privman. Yeah, Flying Bessie. And actually, you know, you knew, to be honest, you kind of knew that the market sort of said, this horse got bet down to 70 cents. Flying Bessie was third choice, you know, off the good start at Colonial. So, anyway, nice performance, Dazzling Blue. But then you had Tom Drury traverse with Joe Talamo, a longest shot on the board in that allowance race. Traverse. Claiborne, homebred. Yeah. Paid $24.70. And won like a good thing. And you also had D. Wayne win with that Cantheros, the nightcap, the maiden special. 2-year-old. Wrecker Point. This one for Holy Cow Stable. Holy Cow! Harry Carey. The Bayerano aboard for this romping winner, and actually did go favored, went off 5-2. So some good, that was a fun sequence. You also had Mumyaz win for Danny Pites. Happy always for Dan to win. This is a Bodemeister, 3-year-old, won a starter allowance. Francisco Arrieta just got up over the co-favorite. Well, actually, C's Get Degrees was the clear second choice. It had been seemingly was close. So good sequence of racing in that, I should mention, in that expensive $150,000 maiden claimer, you had Rusty Arnold. Gold-blooded at about 7-2 for the Bregmans, and that was exciting, right, to have the recent series winning. So that was great. That got probably got a little bit of mainstream. Did it? Must have gotten some mainstream coverage, right? Twitter and such. Paid $874 with Martin Garcia, who I repeat has been having a very he's born again hard. Pick four paid $675, and the pick five starting with Gold Blooded $5,500, and obviously the Drury horse was the key to everything. So. Quite good, and it, even that 20-cent, that pick six, you know, that Derby City six, it, we don't like the jackpots, but the one at Churchill is a little less usurious, the structure of it, and 20-cent winners $3,800 yesterday, if you were able to put those six horses together. So there's just some top line. We got stakes to look at ahead of tomorrow. Of course, it's opening day at Fairgrounds tomorrow. Looking forward to that. Marcus Hirsch will join us. We got to catch up tomorrow with Brad Free and get the Del Mar season going, because we couldn't do it with you last week because we got called out, as you know, out of town. But you've got six new stakes Friday and Saturday already scheduled at Fairgrounds. Turf situation, we'll get an update on that. Doesn't look good. I'm sure at some point, you know, they'll be able to get going. But boy, it's messy right now. You got the Chalukyi Saturday at Churchill. You've got, as I call them, Saturday at Del Mar, the Babalu, the Desi Arnaz, and the Judy, the Cary Grant. So there you go. And more, actually. There's some good racing this weekend. Gio Ponti, hopefully we get that in New York as well. So, all right, let's reach for Gary West. And looking forward to this. I haven't talked to Gary in way, way, way too long. And let me find, where is Tina just sent me a note. We got our flu shots yesterday. Go get a flu shot. Don't be careful about that. Go and get yourself flued up. Tina says her arm is sore. Mine is not. So, I no ill effects actually from no ill effects. Sometimes, right? You get sniffly and you get whatever, and so you know. But no, I feel no issue from. Now Tina says now she wants me to also get a. She wants to also have me get a shingles shot. And so I don't know. I feel like a pincushion after a certain point. It is absolutely a pleasure to have Gary West return to At the Races. Gary, I should apologize first and foremost. Probably a million times I should have called you for comment and insights. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Steve. How are you doing?
I am terrific, and I
assume it's a little cold up there.
It's getting to feel a lot like miserable upstate New York. But it's fine. How much beautiful weather can you take?
That's exactly right.
This is kind of funny because this whole first hour with you and Pat Cummings to follow is sort of, let's call it equal time, Gary, because yesterday it started with Dick Powell, who said, I really want to say something about Gary West's piece in TDN. And that sort of triggered, some ongoing back and forth. And I said, well, I got to get Gary in here to flesh out his thoughts, because you really seem, it's kind of a Larry David-esque kind of a column.
Well, if the tone was one of frustration and anger, that's because I'm pretty frustrated and angry at what's happening in horse racing. And I don't see its so-called leaders doing much about it. If you just look at the last 20 years, the handle's down $2.3 billion. And when adjusted for inflation, that's $3.3 billion. The number of starters is down from 71,000 to 46,000. The foal crop's down 48% in just two decades. It reminds me of that Stevie Smith poem, not waving, but drowning. Some people insulated by their wealth and power think the sport is waving at them, but no, it's not waving. The sport is drowning. So we need to do something about that if we can't.
And I think you may have the wrong guy to quote unquote, speak for the game's leaders, because I've been very critical of what's gone on specifically with HISA. But I think, Gary, the answer would be, well, there are some initiatives that starting with the concept of HISA and rule uniformity and, you know, trying to create an atmosphere that watchdogs, you know, the areas of concern, you know, more vigilantly and more aggressively, et cetera. I would say that on the gambling side, you know, there's been a protracted attention. Some players wouldn't totally agree, but they should at least acknowledge that that, you know, tracks and management has tried to, you know, introduce better pricing on wagers. There's been initiatives that have happened, let's say, and TRA and the change in the withholding rules that's helped churn. You know, so maybe because I'm, you know, doing this 250 days a year, I like to spotlight a lot of what I think has been progress and attempts, you know, to reinforce the good things in the game and fix some of the problems. When it comes to this specific horse, though, it feels like that some of the things that they said and that you took issue with is a little unfair, just because of the level of accomplishment that he you know ends with, and the financial, you know, constraint of covering him with insurance to run him any longer. I mean, it's not a financial viability.
Well, I don't know if that's true, simply because if he wins at Gulfstream Park in January, he basically covers the insurance premium, and so at some point, you have to step back and say, I'm going to do what's best for the sport. And I don't see a lot of owners and breeders doing that. I mean, you can rationalize almost anything by saying, well, it's business. It's like people rationalizing almost anything by saying, God's on my side. Well, at some point, you have to do the right thing, and you have to put the interest of the sport before a self-interest. And I don't see that being done a lot. And that's my main problem here, yeah. Flight line. And that's why I was so upset when he was retired. I wrote that letter, by the way, immediately after I heard he was retired, because I was so frustrated. I look forward to seeing him run next year and hopefully prove how great he is. But we won't have that chance to see him, and he won't have the opportunity to prove that he's one of the greatest of all time. He won, my God, he won six races, and he has a lot left to accomplish. If he is a horse who is beset with frailty and injury, okay, I can understand. But I'm not sure that's the case. And he could certainly run another year and prove his greatness. And again, business is business, but at some point you have to do what's right for the sport, and I don't think they did that. So I'm not going to vote for him for Horse of the Year. It's that simple. I'm just not going to, and it won't make any difference. He's going to be Horse of the Year. We all know that, but it'll make a difference to me. I will feel as though I did what I think is right, and I wish these owners would do what they know is right.
See, my only issue with that posture is that it's not anybody's fault that he missed his 2-year-old. They were on the cusp of getting him to the racetrack as a 2-year-old when he almost destroyed himself and actually, as somebody who tried to get a horse to the races that had a similar incident, a fence, you know, basically impaling himself on a fence as a young horse, and then, you know, having it heal but he didn't. I really haven't brought this horse up, but this was a horse that did not heal equally. In other words, his musculature on the side of his hind end that was punctured did not grow equally with the rest of his opposite side, and as a result, he couldn't stay sound. And here's a horse that may never have even gotten to the races, let alone do what he did. So he would have run as a two-year-old, and who knows what he would have done, and maybe the whole trajectory of his career is different. I'll say again what I've said the last 10 days. To me, Gary, it's a compliment to Sadler and to the horse that off of those layoff lines, he was as dominant as he was coming back with those 90-day, 120-day layoffs.
I agree entirely. It's a tremendous accomplishment. On behalf of the trainers, to keep this horse at that level of performance in spite of a very light racing schedule, and Sadler deserves all the credit in the world. That said, I don't know why he's not racing next year.
Well, how about I'm gonna pull out a champion, and I haven't used his name. But I did actually, after we had that discussion yesterday, I did go glance at champions, and Stage Door Johnny. Stage Door Johnny. 5 for 8 with a second and a third, and with 2 seconds and a third. And it was the three-year-old champion winning the Belmont, the Saranac, and the Dwyer. And the Saranac was on on the main track at that time. Later on became a turf race, but it took him into his third, into his 3-year-old year to break his maiden. It took him 4 tries for Gaver to break his maiden, and the eight race career, and not that Stage Door Johnny, is an all time great, but he's a pretty darn nice horse, and of course went on to an influential career, particularly as a broodmare sire, and. I don't know. I maybe I'm more accepting, Gary, of the the realities of of the game currently. I'll tell you this. I prefer.
Well, Stage Door Johnny was injured, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, but that happens too. I mean, incomplete. An incomplete career, and not that I'm one of these people that's saying this is the all time great. Did you hear Andy Beyer with me last Monday?
No,
because I thought Andy really postured it nicely when he said this is the best horse since Go Zapper and is better than Go Zapper, and he said I would. Take if you want to go back a little further, he said, go to Sunday Silence. He said Andy doesn't think that he's on a par necessarily with the. He said he can be discussed with the greats of the 70s. He said, but Sunday Silence is about as high up on the tick list as Andy felt compelled to go. And I thought that was actually a very good that was a very good and reasonable assessment.
I agree entirely. As I said in the letter, this is probably the most talented horse we've seen in North America since Go Zapper. You can push it even a little further, but he's enormously talented, and I would certainly like to see what more he could accomplish. Stage Door Johnny, he finished his career with 5 consecutive wins, and in the summer of 68, he was spectacular. But we never really got a chance to see how good he might be. But again, that was because of injury. And this horse, I think, could be one of the all-time greats if he had the opportunity to prove that. But if you look at his resume, again, he's got 4 stakes wins, and he never beat an international field. I mean, he really did leave a lot unaccomplished, unachieved, unproven. And we can look at the times, and we can look at the speed figures. We can even measure his stride. His stride, by the way, is enormous, although not quite as long a stride as American Pharoah, but a tremendous racehorse by any measure. but he didn't have the opportunity to prove his greatness. So how obligated are owners to give horses the opportunity to prove his greatness? Someone told me that, I'm letting the horse down by not voting for him as horse of the year. Well, I don't think he will lose any sleep over not getting my vote. But you could make the same argument that his owners have let him down by not giving him the opportunity to prove his greatness.
I guess the last big horse that had to endure this sling and arrow was probably Point Given, right? When Point Given left as a 3-year-old, and everybody's knock on him was he didn't face older horses.
Yeah. This has been going on for decades, right? This retiring horses prematurely. This has been going on a long, long time because the business model in the horse racing is so perverted. You know, you make more money with a stallion than you make with a racehorse. And some progress has been made in creating these mega purses, these lucrative purses that keep horses on the racetrack. That's all very good. But we still have this situation where horses are ushered off to the breeding shed prematurely. And some of these horses aren't even full grown yet, and they're retired. It's a problem. And, you know, a friend of mine the other day who went to the University of Texas, he wanted to see the Texas TCU football game. He doesn't know the first thing in the world about football. He couldn't tell you any player on the Texas team, but he went to the University of Texas. And so he wanted to see this football game. That sport creates loyalties that horse racing has been unable to create, largely because we don't let the stars stay on the stage long enough to nurture fans' loyalties, that they're gone, just as particularly a horse like Flightline, who didn't run in the Triple Crown, you know, that they're gone just as the general public becomes aware of them. Just ask people on the street if they've ever heard of Flightline, and they haven't. But they heard of Zenyatta because she stayed around a while. She created some excitement, and she was very charismatic. This horse is charismatic too, but he hasn't stayed around. Ask people. I remember when Cigar was going on his streak, his tour of America. You know, he ran at Suffolk Downs, he ran at Oaklawn Park, he ran at Gulfstream, he went to Dubai. He gave the world of horse racing a frisson of excitement and a thrill to follow his career. And this horse could have done the same thing. And I think that's very unfortunate that he's not.
Well, you know, the filly and mare conversation is always interesting because they can only have one baby a year. So,
right.
You know, keeping
either, it's going to take either a gilding or a mare to stick around long enough these days, I suppose.
Yeah.
To have a huge following.
I'll maybe this is a problematic, individual to bring up, because he's got plenty of, there's plenty of things to criticize, but, Ahmed Zayat, and granted, there were kickers built into the Coolmore contract for American Pharoah, but what he did keeping Pharoah. I mean, all I remember going into the Belmont that year was, well, this will be his last start if he wins. No, actually, he had a very, very nice second half of the year, and yet. People pile on and take every opportunity to smear Zayat whenever they can. Maybe it's hard, Gary, in this era, not just because of the various constraints and the different things that have worked into the modern game, including sheet methodology and so forth, bounce theory and you know, time between races, et cetera. But, you know, maybe it's difficult because virtually every point on the compass is heard from, and so there's really no consensus when somebody does something that's, you know, very laudable.
Well, that was the problem, of course, with getting uniform medication rules. That you know, the sport had an opportunity for decades to adopt some uniform medication rules and never could get it done. And so finally somebody had to step in. I'm as frustrated with ICE as you are, but frankly, the sport had it coming. It couldn't get its act together. And in this case, again, the sport is paying the price. It's not waving, but drowning. You know, all the metrics point to a serious problem in the game. You know, the handle's down 23% in two decades in terms of real dollars. And yet, the sport isn't doing enough. It just isn't doing enough, largely because its so-called leaders don't recognize their obligation to the sport and the sport's fans. The fans always get overlooked.
Well, and I understand that. I understand that refrain. I do. Well, I.
Although, but I agree, Flightline is a tremendous talent and dazzling. But I do regret.
You want more. You want more.
I want more. Yeah, I want more. Am I greedy? I don't know.
No, you're not greedy. You're not greedy.
I think I'm just reasonable. I would like to see. I would like to see how he stacks up against an international field. I would like to see more. And you know what? I really believe that we never saw the best from him. I think he had more to give.
Well, what we do have was, you know, a bit of a spectacle, particularly here the last two starts with the Pack Classic and the Breeders' Cup Classic, and you know, as I brought up with Sid Fernando yesterday, Gary, there on the financial side, one of the things that is to be appreciated, all the participants in the horse are basically going to take everything that he's produced for them, and they're going to funnel it back into the game. I mean, it is seed money, as it were. I mean, for those that are saying, well, they're taking the money and they may be taking the money, but they're not like taking the money and running away with it. You know, Jane Lyon turned right around and spent close to $5 million on broodmares. You know, within a week of,
right.
You know, so and you know, West Point is, Siena is, Costa is, you know, I from that standpoint, I can't begrudge them, but that's
well, okay, that they're putting money back in the sport, but in a self-serving way, right? I mean, yes, they're not buying yachts with it, but they're buying what they really want with it, which is more horses and
yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Well, doesn't that drive us? That's what drives us. And Gary, I got to say, this entire sport is driven by self-interest at every level, including those of us that are betting. Right? We're not betting to help fund purses. We're betting because we want to win money.
Well, you're right, and I'm not some bleeding heart. You know, we ought to raise horses and spend thousands and thousands of dollars on these horses just out of the goodness of our hearts. But at the same time, at some point, for the good of the sport, I think we have to take a stand.
Yeah, I want to. I'm gonna paraphrase Danny DeVito in Heist. Everybody needs money. That's why they call it money. For those of you that have never seen Heist, run out and or pull it up immediately. Mamet, just brilliant. Gary, what are you up to? What, you know, I see the occasional missive beside letters to the editor. How about ABR work, and where are we seeing Gary West these days?
Well, I'm involved in horse racing as an owner. I have a few horses.
Sweet.
And I do some freelance work. But mainly I've shifted gears, and I'm focused on trying to help Texas move in the right direction.
Yeah.
And that requires a lot of effort.
That requires that'll be a Herculean effort.
Yeah.
Well, Gary, always a pleasure, and I'll put in an early New Year's resolution, and that is to get more Gary West back on a regular basis on At the Races.
Steve, always a pleasure speaking with you. Have a great day.
Thank you, Gary. Gary West, everybody, long time Fort Worth Star Telegram turf writer, and thoughtful and expressive, and just one of the really good people in the press box for years and years. And I'm sure I should have probably brought him up, especially with Fairgrounds opening tomorrow. He and Bob Fortas were an absolute entry, just like Fontaine and Haskin, and then later Haskin and Shulman, Fortas and West, just inseparable. Yeah. Let's bring in another as we continue equal time. I think we're going to have to, I'm going to have to find a sponsor for this equal time. we basically spend like a Tuesday, using some unsuspecting individual as a pinata, and then we bring them on and let them. Maybe I should do it in reverse order, Pat. Pat Cummings, good morning.
Next in the queue.
This happened. Yeah, the best part, the best things that happened, on the show are always organic, right?
We could go on a riff about my mom's Thanksgiving stuffing, if you want.
Well, go ahead. Oh, I forgot to ask Gary about his. Over the years, I'm sure Gary has reflected, but let's start out with that.
She is big on the potato bread. The Martin's potato bread, which I think is a little more regional for some, but Martin's potato bread is the centerpiece of the stuffing.
Right.
And, the whole onion, celery, chicken stock, spices. But, the potato bread makes it far more than just a normal kind of bread stuffing or cornbread stuffing or anything like that. I just love it. It's my absolute favorite centerpiece, and they're coming down here to Kentucky for Thanksgiving. So mom's actually bringing the potato bread with her.
Well,
so,
and
looking forward to it.
I do see the Martin's potato bread cubes, and they're a little bigger than your standard crouton sized, Arnold or Pepperidge Farm, and. That's interesting, actually, about the Martins. Did you see about the explosion and the fire at the plant?
No.
Oh, my God.
When?
About 6 weeks ago, there was a...
I think
a worker or two may have been killed. There was a bad situation, and I was traveling, so it probably was in September, but if anybody does, Martin's potato bread plant fire.
There it was in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Kills one.
That's what I thought.
Very unfortunate.
That's what I thought. And I wondered if it was going to interfere with their production. Most notably the great rolls, the potato rolls. I my favorite of theirs is the hot dog roll. I like the hot dog roll.
Also delicious.
Yeah,
they're the plant was in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania.
I know Chambersburg very well. In fact, right up.
I did 4 years in Carlisle.
Did you really?
I went to Dickinson College.
Dickinson, that's right. I forgot you went to Dickinson.
And my Kentucky Derby betting, it was kind of, do you want to go to Penn National or the Penn National OTB in Chambersburg. And so you kind of had a choice, but because it was during the day, Penn National wouldn't run until later at night. So I wanted to get my bets in early. So we'd head down to Chambersburg, and that was the source of my Kentucky Derby betting for 4 years. So pre-ADW, it was, I tell you, for Franklin County, Pennsylvania, they packed them in there, Steve.
Well, that's just south of Slippery Rock, right?
No. Slippery Rock's up north. In the Northwest.
Well, what's the, there's a school.
Shippensburg.
Shippensburg. Thank you. Shippensburg State.
Yep. Just south of Shippensburg.
That's what I thought. And not Slippery Rock, but, cause we've got a Derby Trail. We've got one of the coaches, is longtime Derby Trailer, is a coach at Shippensburg. Tina and I were on our way to Montpelier, to see Woodbury and for the jump races, the fall jump races. And I found a bed and breakfast in Chambersburg, and I had never been through there. And of course it's a big mm-hmm. Civil War region.
Yeah.
And we had as nice a night and breakfast the next morning. And then we had a couple of minutes to kind of zip around, Chambersburg to see the night for dinner, Friday night, we found some, it was a cute little town. The B&B was for sale. It's a beautiful sort of a almost an antebellum style, mansion. And, really our first, I think that may have been our first as a couple, our first, B&B experience, to be honest. And, speaking of baked, baked casseroles, she made a almost like a creme brulee French toast like they have at the Brewster Inn in Casanova.
But you know what's not far from there is just over in Mercersburg,
yeah,
just west of Chambersburg is the birthplace of James Buchanan, our 15th president,
and only bachelor president.
He was. Now here's a random story in this wacky day. I heard you early. I knew this is the sort of day to bring this up. But in the throes of the pandemic, the early months, I was, there was no sports on TV at night, and there was only so much you could do otherwise. I said, I want to tackle a couple topics, read some things to just answer some questions, right, that I had about American history. And I ordered James Buchanan's 500-page biography by a professor from Penn State University. And I'm telling you, it was a fascinating read. It really was, to get all details of Pennsylvania's only president, I might add. Only bachelor, and I wanted to know how bad he was in terms of leading us into the Civil War and the explanations thereof. And I'll tell you, you got him. It became crystal clear how Buchanan failed the country. Really interesting read, actually.
There you go. Things come up that you wouldn't have expected.
I'm staring at it here. Philip Klein is the author. I recommend it. There's not many in print, but go get it if you can.
Well, if we're bringing up local bad presidents, I am coming to you from the birthplace and childhood home of Chester A. Arthur.
There you go.
And you know what's funny? I may have said this on the air. And by the way, I did forget one thing. Yesterday was Seth Merrow. Saturday night here in Greenwich, formerly known as the Union Village, and also known because we put together the first New York, regiment for the Civil War came from Greenwich, first to assemble. And so we became Union Village. But before that, Whipple City, for Jeb Whipple, who was an early creator of the plow, one of the first mass-marketed, mass-produced plows. Chet Arthur, it's so funny. You know those banners you get? It's become very popular to put in towns. You got these banners of the veterans, mm-hmm. all the veterans.
Yep.
So, you know, you go down, they'll go down Main Street here,
yeah.
Route 29, and there's all these vets, and it's great. And, you know, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, whatever. And right in the village square, essentially, there's one of these banners, and there's Chester A. Arthur, Commander in Chief. I hadn't thought of that, but yes, I guess that is right. That is a military role. So he was a veteran. It's very funny. I mean, you got all these doughboys and whatnot. So that brings us back to Doughboy. Doughboys brings us back to dough and the stuffing. Tina's favorite as well. And nobody segues like Beck.
Never knew how we were going to get back there, but we did.
Pat, we've got them now engrossed, and they're all tied on. Explain why you seem. I let Gary West explain why he was so upset about Flightline. Explain why you're so upset about this Quinella incident, which to me looks like a bunch of players got five times what they normally would have by this affair.
And you're right about that. And anytime there is an incident of pool manipulation, and we've got dozens of them in the last 6 months, horse players do end up receiving more. Those who were betting legitimately through the legal parimutuel pools, they end up getting a bigger return than they anticipated. And that, I think, tends to be sometimes why we don't hear much about this. And we kind of look at it and say, oh, parimutuel anomaly, I'll take it, right? I'm not arguing that players do end up getting more. Now, for perspective, the Quinella pool at Gulfstream, and for that matter, Naira, Del Mar, it's most people, I don't think, had even thought about the Quinellas all that much, to be fair. They average about $4,000, $5,000 a race. All of those tracks, really. And of course the exactives, are, 25 times that, in some cases, and in most cases, to be fair. So, it is typically the smallest pool that we've seen at just about any of these tracks. And a small pool, of course, is just generally more ripe for manipulation. Now, here's the rub. This quest is about ensuring horse players are confident in the outcomes that take place on the track, and that there is no other behavior that is taking place that horses may not be running on their own merits, that a horse is being held, or that performance has either been degraded or, of course, enhanced through some substance. Of course, that is something that's an area that is well covered by many other people. And back when, in 2021, when we were writing the Wagering Insecurity series, we had a section in there about gray market betting, about the role that these unregulated operators have in betting. I'm not trying to kill it, not trying to stamp it out. Always will be there. Never going to get rid of it. It's whack-a-mole. But it does have an impact on the sport. If people are betting and trying to pull off coups offshore and affecting the legitimate outcome onshore. And in the course of, we were just writing about it in general, right? That this is something we need to be attentive to. We offered a couple examples, mostly from Europe, about this. And in the course of writing, a horse player had actually, I think, reached out to Pete Fornital, and Pete sent it on to me. He said, what do you think about this? And I said, that's pool manipulation. And this was in a Quinella pool at Will Rogers. And we looked into it, and someone had essentially sacrificed about $4,000 in a pool that typically handled about $800 to manipulate the pool to get a bigger result on a legitimate outcome, right? So they're betting 30-1 over the field. The Quinella was paying $1.05 for every dollar bet, and a very legitimate outcome ended up paying like $60. And for the horse players that legitimately bet it, good for them. But for you know, if the wacky result ends up coming in, if there's an incident in the race and it so happened, if there's a DQ, if something otherwise happens, the people who were otherwise legitimately betting that race, as few as they may be, might be looking and say, this horse paid $60 to win and I got a dollar back on the Quinella. Well, what's going on here? Was there anything else involved? And that was the question I got from Frank Mastari, a very well-known horse player, contest player. He won the Monmouth contest earlier this year. And Frank reached out to Marshall Graham. Marshall Graham contacted me, and then I got in contact with Frank. And Frank's like, I'm looking at this race. I'm like, what's happening here? That this, you know, Frank thought, and we put it in there, that the favorite was much too short. Okay. So he's going back and looking at the race afterwards and saying, geez, you know, what did I miss here? This horse took a lot of action. And then he noticed the Quinella pool is as out of whack as it is. And I said, you know, this is just the most egregious example of pool manipulation that we've seen in the last 6 months. Now, normally we see $1,000, $2,000, $3,000. Someone came in and really structured a series of bets, $18,000, on a combination they did not expect to win. It was a sacrifice. They intended to lose and steam the legitimate outcome. And other bets, you know, we don't know exactly what they bet offshore.
Stop for a minute there. And of course, you know, the offshore part of this is worth discussing, because if you know, considering they contribute nothing to the pools, they contribute nothing to, you know, infrastructure and to the purse accounts. So if they get slaughtered, good. That's sort of a sidebar to this.
Yeah. No love lost there, right?
Right.
And surely some of them did, and, you know, they deserve it, right? But the concern, you know, and yes, horse players who care about the sport should not be betting with offshore entities. You got to bring that money back on. You got to bet legitimately. It's the best thing for racing, for operators, and for horsemen, and it's the respectful thing to do. But they cover a market. They offer a product. There are states in this country that still do not have legal ADW betting. And frankly, it just encourages those players to go offshore. I mean, it is a disgrace that Texas does not have ADW betting, right?
Yes.
And the fact that we have not been able to accomplish that as an industry is, you know, it's a long-term loss on our record. But maybe that'll change in the next session. I'm hopeful, and I know it's something that's being discussed and that a lot of people have been talking about. We need to legitimize that marketplace, and the fact that you can only bet horse racing in Texas at a racetrack is a lose for the sport long term, and has been. The question that comes into play is anyone trying to manipulate the legitimate outcome to help exercise this betting coup? And, you know, I had a random horse player in Frank Mastari, you know, ask that question of a friend, and then I talked to him, and, you know, Frank was pretty riled up about it. And it's actually something that after the Will Rogers incident that we wrote about in April of 2021, we started tracking and built a program to monitor incidents of this. It took a while to get that done, and working with some partners in doing so. But look, we've got, you know, dozens of examples of this in the last 6 months. It does happen more than I think people necessarily recognize. And typically it's just small pools that get pillaged. Delaware, Thistle. I believe it was four races in one day at Thistle. And you watch the replays and you look and you say, is this horse even trying? Are the stewards paying attention? That's what this is about. It's about the confidence of the outcomes that we see. And that is the, you know, that's the reality of this, that this is, this was the biggest incident that we had seen in 6 months. And, you know, it had finally broken onto a major stage, and just don't want to have horse players questioning these sorts of outcomes. And it's all about drawing greater attention to the results that are on the track, improving integrity, improving oversight. Just want a better sport or a more sustainable sport. And are the existing operators and regulators really attentive to that? Not as much as they should be, because we've talked to the regulators, right? I did a seminar for the ARCI and Martin's group and commissioners all across the country about this summer. I talked to the Organization of Racing Investigators about it in March. And to be fair, the regulators didn't seem to have a whole lot of interest. They're not interested. They just want to regulate. They don't want to get involved with the betting menus. I get it. But look, very much to their credit, we raised it to first, had contact with them on Saturday morning. And by Tuesday, the Quinella pool was done with very little back and forth from us. So I thought that was indicative of you know, their attentiveness after it was raised to them. Fair credit to them. And, you know, chatting with some of the folks in New York. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we see Del Mar get rid of it too next year. It's a small pool. This is a broken window, Steve, right? This is not a burning fire. This is a broken window. We want to clean up as many of them as we can. And that's what it's about.
Well, at the same time, Pat, there's players that, you know, that are interested in, or, you know, like to play it. I suppose
not many, though. Right?
Well, not many, but it would have, I don't know, taking away. I suppose that any of that play would gravitate, you know, into exacta pools readily.
Right.
It's about
being, you know, can our wagering menu in the present day, when it's more easy to do these things like this, there's a whole nother topic. It gets down another rabbit hole, and I don't want to go down it here, but it does involve cryptocurrency and how crypto is being used in the offshore market. To facilitate a lot of this and kind of make it easier to play in that space. But it has become easier to manipulate pools. And should harness tracks be offering place and show betting when the total amount in both pools ends up to be maybe $2,000? Should we have $1,000 place and show pools, or should we just have one show pool? Should tracks have rolling doubles in the present day and age? There's small circuits where those double pools get $2,000, $3,000. That wasn't worth writing about. But then it hit Gulfstream. And it's hit one other, I would call at least a mid-major track in recent months. But again, not enough that we said, gosh, we really need to go full bore on this. But this was a big amount, and you know, I think it's about the operators being attentive to the menu that they offer, trying to increase liquidity where they can. And you know, it's just the game isn't the same as it once was.
How do you? Because you're detailing a handful of incidents here, Pat, and of course this is something that Curtis Linnell and TRPB, I mean, that's their principal, you know, raison d'etre now, and you know, as opposed to some of the, you know, the backstretch work that was made famous by Paul Berube. Mm-hmm. Is it happening to a lesser extent in larger pools, more undetected? And, you know, I asked the question early this morning, if you were listening, you know, how is this that different from the algorithm of the CAW leaving combinations, certain combinations uncovered, and you know, essentially in the, at the big venues, and you know, we're certainly seeing enough underpaid exactas. There's plenty of overpays as well for the same, you know, the inverse. So how is this different?
I think it's different in that a customer or customers is individually on these occasions where it happens, they are truly attempting to manipulate the outcome. They're not trying to win. They're not trying to place winning bets. They are trying to inflate the payouts, and it could end up negatively affecting individual customers in ways that we don't know. And I look, there was an example in Delaware in July. A horse ends up going off as the show pool favorite, who wins at 46-1. You pay $96 to win and $260 to show. There wasn't some big outcry about it. I don't think a lot of people noticed. But for the legitimate customer who's legitimately betting on that 46-1 chance, I don't think they necessarily expected that that 46-1 shot was going to pay them $260 to show. We've seen it in the standard bred side too. The difference, though, I think, is that the groups like Elite Turf Club and the RGS players, they are backing, you know, their money is legitimate. They are covering many different combinations. They're getting rebated, certainly, but they do want to win. They want to churn. And you know, I think that the industry needs to address the impact of the late price crunches that they do instill on everybody else. I kind of joke now that, you know, you don't bet a horse. You take the price Elite gives you. They end up setting the market in a lot of these. The interesting thing on this particular incident is that the algorithms, this coup is not exacted with perfection by any stretch. The play started a little early. Normally we see this money come in the last flash so that the algorithms don't have a chance to respond. In this incident, the money started coming in on the combinations with the longest shot on the board, minute and a half out from the start of the race. The algorithms did respond and came in and cut the actual price. So, you know, it was a bit of a shot on the person who was trying to manipulate the pool. And the probable went from $81 to $42. And so the algorithm actually kind of, it was a little bit of a self-regulation at that point where one big player came in and took advantage of what was going on. That doesn't happen in most of these examples. We want players to be confident in the pools that they're participating in. Right. Parimutuel wagering is great, but it needs to be maintained and modernized, improve the technology. And this is just, I think, a pretty random example of one of the things that tracks need to be staying attentive to. How they engage and allow the CRWs to play. Full credit to NYRA, Steve, right? They're the one entity that has stepped out and said, we're not going to let them play in the win pool in the last 2 minutes. And as a result, those pools stay remarkably steady. It is noticeable. I know Marshall Graham has done some research on this that I think we're going to hear about in Arizona. Going to hear about this topic more in Arizona, too, specifically on the greater role of illegal betting with some real international experts that are coming in to talk about that. But you got to present a product that people trust, and, you know, trust hit somebody. There was a hit to confidence here in this particular incident, not the end of the world. But it's a broken window, and, full credit also to First for closing the pool, acting. And yes, it's probably going to frustrate a couple customers. But I think for the greater good and confidence of all stakeholders, whether they know it or not, it was the right decision.
Fair enough, and we will talk. And actually, gosh, if today's what the 17th, so 17th,
24th, 2.5 weeks.
Yeah,
right?
2.5 weeks. We will be there, December 5th, 6th, 7th, at University of Arizona, the Racetrack Industry Program Symposium on racing and gaming. And Pat, I appreciate it. I wanted to give you a chance to flesh this out for those that didn't read the treatment
it was not the way I intended to write it, Steve, but when they dropped that press release, I kind of had to run with what I had. So it was not as edited as I would have liked it to have been. But them's the breaks.
who does the editing for you, Pat?
Rather not go into it. Someone you know.
Pat Cummings, everybody. Pat Cummings, TIF.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks a lot. Happy Thanksgiving. I will see you in just 2.5 weeks, as we said. I'll see him on Sunday. We'll be at Lowe's, Ventana Canyon. Lowe's Canyon, Ventana. I never, that I've been going 10 years and I still can't get the 2 years at the Sorbonne and she still gets it wrong. Oh my God. We could take a break. There you go. My favorite year weighing in. The Himalayas. Let's see. Casey, maybe we should take a break. Thank you. I think Alan Swan is beneath us. Of course he's beneath us. He's an actor. Here's another big recommendation for the holidays with you got the family. If you've never stopped, sorry, I guess we got to leave. My favorite year when the family's in town. Back after this, Tony Black.
North America, but we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently standing.